That's where your freedom lies in human life. The animals, the plants, have consciousness, but they basically use it to eat, to find food, to look for a place to sleep, for mating, and for defending themselves. But in human life, we become introspective. We say, well, why am I here? What is the purpose of my life? So consciousness is there. The Vedic account is that it's the particular embodiment that gives us greater freedom. The tree is very restricted in what it can do. It can stand there with its arms in the air, and that's about it. Some other creatures have more freedom. They can wander around. But in the human life, you get the freedom to inquire. The freedom to inquire.
It's a lovely question also, because the description of an advanced spiritualist is one who's able to honor life in all of its forms. There's a verse in the Gita that says, the pundit, wise person, sees the equality of life, whether it be in human form, animal form, whatever it may be, and that there's a sense of stewardship rather than exploitation of other life forms. So it's that ability to recognize the spark of the divine in all life, whatever it may be, however high or low, which is a symptom of spiritual advancement.
A dendrite just reappeared. Luther Burbank.
Yes, we can still do it. Okay.
A couple of years more.
A few more miles to go. Okay.
No.
Yes.
Question here. What is the, or can you describe the intelligence that determines the path at the point of expiration of one life into another, that determines where that soul will reside? And, you know, among the literally uncountable number of instantiations of life that occur on this planet.
Are you saying what determines where we will go?
What is that intelligence behind, or the force that creates a deterministic direction in which, let's say, my soul will wind up in some other body? How is that determined? What is the intelligence behind it? How does it occur?
Mm. Very interesting question. Let's look at it from two angles of vision. First, my own involvement. It's said that what we think of at the time of death determines what our next life will be. What I think of at the time of death, that our mentality at death, the content of our consciousness, transfers us to the next life. So that's one way of looking at it. But another way of looking at it, and perhaps more in tune with the way you're asking it, is how is this law of transfer from one life to another enforced or directed? Who's in charge of it, or how does it, what directive power is there? And the Bhagavad Gita says that ultimately it's God who's responsible for this, but he doesn't get involved in all of the things. He doesn't say, okay, George Smith at 432 East 13th Street just died, and okay, where are we going to send him? Well, but that there are laws of nature, laws of karma, laws of action and reaction, which say essentially that the cumulative total of what we've done during this life entitles us, not only entitles us, but obliges us to accept a particular body. Let's say you're living in a house, you've got a certain job, and at a certain point you say, well, I've had it with this house, I want a new one. What determines where you can go? There are certain external conditions, and then there are certain very immediate conditions, like how much money you have. If you have this big a budget, you can get this kind of house, you can live in this place. If you have a larger budget, you can go to a different place, smaller budget, get a little flat somewhere. So what kind of credit we have, essentially. So as we live our lives, we get credit, and we get debits also. By doing certain things, we elevate ourselves. We entitle ourselves to a better future. Just as in this life, you know, you invest 4 years of college and you presumably get a better job opportunities and better understanding of the world. That entitles you to go this way or that way. So what we invest in this life, some of the activities give us the opportunity for elevation, and some of the things that we do oblige us to go down or subtract from our credit or put us in the negative. And so that's all totaled up at the time of death. So that God has his representatives who are in charge of the laws of nature, more elevated beings, just as there's a police department here and there's a public welfare department, there's a housing authority and so on. And they decide so many things about, you know, okay, this guy he's been waiting on the list for 20 years and now he's eligible to get this department. And this guy, we've been looking for him for 20 years and now he's going to jail.
And it's right about here that we lose half our audience.
Yeah, the half that goes to jail.
Well, there's that half. Then there's the half that says, well, wait a minute now, if I'm understanding you correctly, what you're saying is basically people get what they deserve.
What's surprising about that?
Well, if we were going to sober up for a moment about the question and take it seriously, somebody might say, what possible offense could a child have performed that would obligate this innocent young person to be born with all kinds of birth defects and other horrible conditions and live in suffering all the time?
He could have blown up the World Trade Center in the previous life.
All right. Then taking this analogy just a little bit further, does that mean that people who died in the camps during the Holocaust, did they get what they deserved?
Why would we make an exception of them? Why would we say that everybody else lives and dies according to their previous background, but these people didn't?
Well, if we go by the accounts, the question then would become, what possible offense could so many millions of people have been performing, all on such an extremely deep level of darkness, that they would all suffer the same extreme, unimaginable pain and misfortune?
The laws of nature get very subtle. First of all, we're dealing not only with one life or two lives, but more lives than we can count. Something catches up with me, good or bad, from last life, something from 10 lives back, sometimes something from 15 lives back. It gets very intricate. And it works out, the machinery of it works out not only individually, but collectively. Not only do I die in a plane crash, but 142 other people die in the same plane crash. Because by the laws of cause and effect, those 142 people were all brought together at the same time to reap a shared destiny. It can be 142, it can be 142 million. What people can do to deserve that, we see around us. We see the things that the people do to one another. Or at least we read about the things that people can do to one another.
Well, by that description, does it mean that the Hitlers of the world and the drunk pilots of aviation are all messengers of destiny?
And recipients. You know, where will Mr. Hitler, what does Mr. Hitler get as his next life? And then, you know, someone asks, well, what did this innocent child do? Well, it was Adolf Hitler in his last life. So everyone is both an agent and a recipient of karma. We have a question in the back here.
I've reflected on this question that Yogeshwar has asked you about the Holocaust. And one of the many, many things I've thought of is that for a long time, hunting people of the Jewish faith was a practice. And I kept thinking, those people who hunted them, they all came together in the 1930s and early 40s to get what they dished out. That's the only thing I've been able to think of, but it made some sense to me because it was such a... I mean, for 1,000 years, people of the Jewish faith were hunted and slaughtered in pogroms all over Europe and so on. So to me, it seemed like it's not singling out and becoming racist that, oh, Jews got what they deserved. Because I'm thinking, well, what were they in their past life?
Exactly.
And what did they do to Jews? Mm-hmm. Now they're getting what they did. That's how I thought about it.
Can I interject a qualifier here at this point? I think it's critical to understand that this Vedic philosophy, this description of how souls move from one lifetime to the next and what their fortunes are in those many lifetimes, does not in any way, shape, or form negate the necessity for active social involvement. It does not mean that therefore we are all subjects of our karma. And so it doesn't really matter what we do. It's all kind of settled up by these impersonal mechanical laws of the universe. In fact, quite the opposite. The deeper understanding of these cosmic principles is meant to motivate us to become more, not less, involved in the work of the world. In fact, it gives us finally some valid justification other than just the idea that being a good person is a nice idea. It gives it some ontological substance that our souls are at stake and there is a reason to become involved in what, since we're talking about the Jewish people, would be called tikkun, or the healing of the world, the working as instruments of God in the world for the forward movement of humanity.
Hello? I have a small question about this, and it's I don't know, in Vedas is there something as as progression of time, there was something, I don't know if you're familiar with that, the age of, like, there was first in India, ancient India, which was supposedly associated with the cow, with the Taurus sign, and then there was the age of Aries, which is associated with the ram, which is Jewish symbol, and then there's a new symbol, which is Jesus of this time and this age, and I think that could be one way of explaining all the extinct. What has happened to Jewish people, and I think it was just natural that we were coming to another time, but they were holding on to their beliefs so strongly, and there was, hence, because of that, the conflict. But the question is, does this exist in Vedas, this explanation of progression of time? Now they're saying in 2012 we are coming to a new age, age of Aquarius. Do Vedas cover that at all?
There is a Vedic account of a progression of ages with different features to them. According to that account, we wouldn't really look forward to seeing Aquarius in 2012. The Vedic account says that there are four ages, and there are times, or the time scale is really vast. So that the shortest one is 500,000 years. That's the age that we're in now, of which 5,000 years have passed. According to that account, this is the worst of the ages. And it gets not better, but worse. Things deteriorate in the present age. But within this age, although it's really the worst age for spiritual realization, the account is that in previous ages, people were very elevated in their consciousness, and they could meditate, and they had greater facility for spiritual realization. But in the present age, the Kali Yuga is called the age of dissension and quarrel and hypocrisy. The good thing is that by chanting any name of God, one can become free from material entanglement and attain liberation. Special feature of the present age. That's the Vedic account. The Vedic literature doesn't get into small scale time, you know, what's happening in the next 12 years, what's happening in the next 20 years, but this larger cosmic picture.
Is that all the time we have? Perhaps just as a closing
remark.
He's
in charge of the small scale time.
closing remarks is don't let the laws of reincarnation throw you. There are simple things that you can do to keep yourself healthy. Watch your diet, exercise regularly, chant Hare Krishna, and please do come back to other programs here at the Bhakti Center, and we'll hope to enthrall you with even deeper discussions on the philosophy of the Bhagavad Gita.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you to our two special guests, Jagvaita Swami and Yogeshwar. Wow, really interesting presentation. It's such a deep subject that you can see the questions started off slow, but gradually picked up so much that I'm sorry to